Welcome to What in God's Name. He's Chris Owen.
And she is Shayna Appel.
And we are the podcast that looks at contemporary issues through the lenses of theology and philosophy. How you doing today, Chris?
I am great. I wanted to fill you in on my Alexa obsession.
Oh my God, here we go. Still?
Our listener who's been emailing about my Alexa obsession did not email this time, and so my Alexa obsession is passing, so we won't mention the A word for now. Although, if you find yourself in a room with an Alexa, we do recommend that you say, Alexa, play What in God's Name podcast, and then you'll hear the funky music.
For those of you who haven't been listening, Chris has been mentioning Alexa on our show, and it's been triggering people's Alexas. So, Chris, what else do you have for us today?
I wanted to share with you a dream I had. You know, we're getting ready for a fund drive beginning at the end of February. And so one morning, I was between waking and sleeping, and I had this dream slash fantasy that What in God's Name, you and I and Arlo went on Shark Tank.
How'd we do?
And I said, for $1 million, we will give you 50% of our show. And Mark Cuban said, what are your assets? And I said, well, I'm really smart. And Shayna here, she's really smart and she's funny. And we have Arlo, our little Shih Tzu.
He's invaluable.
And Mark Cuban raised his eyebrows, kind of gave his little sneer and said, I'm out. And then Arlo growled.
Ergo, listeners, it's still up to you to keep this show floating. This is going to be a Lenten? Just during the season
we're
of Lent,
yeah? Yes, through the season of Lent, starting the end of February.
Wonderful. So today we are listening to part three of an interview that Chris and I did with Reverend Kathleen McTeague, a phenomenal, phenomenally gifted speaker and preacher and political mind. For those of you who listened last week, we teased you a little bit. That was Chris's idea. You can blame him. Kathleen alludes to the spiritual, and then we ended the interview. So when we pick up today, Kathleen is talking about the intersection between faith and activism, faith and doing justice work.
Yeah, we teased the spiritual practices and what makes an activity a spiritual practice. And the context in which this arises is that she talks about compassion and seeing the humanity in the other. So, Shayna, let's listen to part three.
So first of all, let's say spiritual practices come in a huge variety of flavors, right? Lots of different forms of prayer, lots of forms of meditation, kinetic practices like yoga or tai chi or walking, right? I have a colleague whose name is Jorge Esquivel, who lives in Colombia, who helped me, because of his own thinking, to boil it down to three elements that make something a practice. It's like if you were saying, okay, what makes this just a walk versus now this walk is a spiritual practice? What's the difference? And what Jorge boiled it down to, and he's probably not the first, but he's the one who was the first for me, is that, first of all, it's intentional. Like, it doesn't just fall on you. You have to intend to do it. In Buddhism, we say you have to get your butt on the cushion. So it's intentional. It is attentional. That means it is meant to cultivate your attention. It is meant to help you get rid of all of the constant noise that's going on in our heads all the time and just get quiet. Watch your breath. Pay attention. So it's attentional. And the third thing is it's repeated. It is something you are trying to do over and over again so that it becomes a habit. And the reason I segued into that is because it seems to me that one of the core gifts of a spiritual practice is that they force us to pay attention to who we are and how we are behaving. You can frame it as they help us to see our shadows. And so the reason I think compassion arises from that is because the more clearly I have to see my shadow, the harder it is for me to project that shadow onto somebody else. If I have to own my own short-temperedness, if I have to own that lashing out at the person yesterday when they bumped into me in the supermarket was the wrong thing to do and I feel kind of ashamed of it, it actually is going to help me be more forgiving the next time someone lashes out at me. That's how it works.
Thinking about these virtues, and it's interesting you use the word virtue because Shane and I've been using that word and thinking about, you know, we've been talking about a war zone in Nicaragua. My thinking gravitates to our culture, society today here in the United States, what I perceive as the need to cultivate virtues in our citizens so that we can actually have real conversations with one another.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think cultivating virtues so that we can see one another is one thing. Yeah. And recognizing the need to listen to people, particularly to people who we have figured out some way to define as the other, is also important. So an example of that being I'm white, and I grew up in Spokane, Washington, which is a pretty white city. It just is. Its largest racial minority, at least when I was growing up there, was American Indian, was Native communities rather than Black. And because I grew up in a largely white environment, it was very easy for me to internalize othering people of color in ways I was utterly unaware of. And I think a huge part of my both spiritual and political work as an adult, as I became aware gradually of how I had internalized basically the messages of racism, is unlearning that stuff, figuring out ways to constantly unlearn whatever those little insidious messages were about the other because that person is Black or because that person is brown or whatever the other thing might be. And I think that that's a core part of any spiritual practice, is how do we see every human being as a human being and undo the othering that we've been taught.
I think upholding the inherent worth and dignity of all people is the easiest thing in the world to do until I actually have to, you know, get up out of bed in the morning. And then the challenge begins, you know, because if I turn on the news, I'm already screaming at people and it's 7 o'clock in the morning. You may have already addressed this, Kathleen, but the complexities of the problems that we are facing at home and abroad these days, you know, we get past the model of service and into the struggle for justice. That is a much, I think I mentioned this earlier, it's a longer arc. It's a protracted struggle. What are the kinds of tools that you have found that equip people for that longer term struggle? Because it has been my experience that we white people tend to want to like go in, fix something and move on. And the work for justice, it's longer, it's protracted. There are many cultures among us who have dealt with protracted struggle forever. It is something, it's a new cultural norm, I think, for most white people.
Speaking for myself, but I have also observed this in other people, I think it is one of the things we gain from a spiritual practice. A spiritual practice of whatever form works for a person does many things for us. And I think entering into it as a transactional thing is probably a mistake, but I got to talk in these terms because it's hard to speak of it except by saying here are some of the things that can arise from a spiritual practice when it's engaged in regularly. One of those things, though, is that it gives us some perspective. It anchors us in something greater than ourselves. We don't need to use the word God if we're uncomfortable with it in order to recognize that at least we ourselves are not God. And I think that spiritual practices help us remember that. They also help us remember that in addition to not ourselves being God, being the be-all and the end-all, that in any justice struggle in which we engage, and I mean that literally, I don't think there's any justice struggle that isn't a long one. There's, you know, you may have an immediate victory, but it's part of the long struggle against racism or against poverty or against imperialism, right? I mean, they're all long struggles. There's no such thing in justice as a short struggle, just episodes. And when we are grounded, I think there are two things that can happen. One is that we recognize we are part of something far, far larger than ourselves. And in addition to those of us who are theistic, thinking in terms of God or the great mystery, it's also true that we're part of a flow of life and intention and struggle that goes back farther than we can imagine. You know, standing on the shoulders of the ancestors who have fought for these things before us, many of whom devoted their entire lives to their struggle for liberation, for their own or for others' liberation, and never lived to see the change, but never stopped. and we're part of a flow that goes forward in time. So again, I have three kids. I think about what life will be like 50 years from now for them, long after I'm gone. And what we do today is not just for today's results. It builds on what was done in some cases 100 years ago, in some cases 5 years ago, and it is meant to change things for those generations that will come after us. So there's another virtue we don't talk about very often that is steadfastness, or it can be called other words, but I think steadfast is a fabulous word. You know, it reminds me of the mighty oak by the, you know, mm-hmm. standing by the water, right? It's like, I shall not be moved, that mm-hmm. we've got to anchor ourselves that way in the long arc and believe we are part of something that transcends any immediate victory or defeat. That's what keeps us going. And I think the other thing, for those of us who are even from relative privilege, and I would put into that category every person who walks through this world wearing a white skin, is to recognize the struggles that people don't have an option about. If I'm Black moving through the world in the United States of America, I will be engaging with racism because it's going to come at me. I don't have the luxury of saying, I'm tired now, I'm worn out, I'm not going to fight.
I did that. You know, I've put my time in.
I put my time in, right?
I'm done dealing with racism. So, I bet there's a lot of Black people who would like to be able to say that.
Yeah, of course. So given that they can't lay that burden down, mm-hmm. if I actually care, not so much even about that issue of racism, but care about them, care about my siblings of color who are moving through this world under that particular oppression, then I'm not going to lay it down either. I wanted to say something else about the steadfastness that I'm going to tell you a story because I really like this story. Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is a brilliant and poetic writer, shortly after his book Between the World and Me came out, he was giving a public presentation that I was fortunate enough to be able to go to. It was in Washington, D.C. Nick and I both went. And the first part of his presentation was an interview by the guy who's the editor of The Atlantic, which Coates used to write for a lot. I haven't seen him in there more recently. And then the second half of the presentation was just Q&A. So people lined up, you know, to ask him questions. And the audience was probably 50% people of color. And pretty much everybody who got up and asked a question was Black. And there were really interesting questions from people, for instance, who are teaching in the public school system in Washington, D.C. What do I say to these kids to give them hope? You know, questions like that. And there were two answers that I heard Coates give that just stuck with me so deeply. So this one man, Black man, who came up to the microphone and said, I'm teaching in these city schools. Every child I've got is struggling. Every child I've got is living with poverty and racism. How do I give them hope? And what Coates said was again, just such humility and clarity. He said, look, what I think of are the people, our ancestors, yours and mine, who lived in slavery. And as far back as they could look, their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, their great-great-grandparents had been enslaved. And they knew that if they'd had the capacity to look forward as far as they could see, and it was true for many of them, their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, they were all going to be in slavery. And they did not give up. And he said, who am I? Who am I to say there is not hope with ancestors like that in my past? That was one answer he gave. The second one he gave that just, I found myself actually weeping from it because it resonated so deeply for me, is someone came up to the mic and enchanted as we had all been with his forthrightness and his just, really his brilliance. I just think he's quite brilliant. Leaned into the mic and said, have you ever thought about running for office? And of course, everybody laughed. Coates laughed, you know, like he had articulated so well our hunger for that kind of leadership. So the question made sense, but Coates said, you know, I'm not a politician. I'm not really even very much of a political activist. I'm a poet and a writer. Mm-hmm. That's what mm-hmm. I do. And I think of that as my little acre that I've been given. And my job is to till that acre as well as I possibly can. And I've got to remember that all around me, people have other acres that mm-hmm. they're tilling. And I've got to trust in that. It is not mine to do it all. It's mine to till this little acre as mm-hmm. well as I mm-hmm. can. And I heard that with such a wash of liberation, because I think we are so often guilty of telling ourselves, we've got to do this and we've got to do that. And, you know, I don't know if that's a white issue or if it's a issue of privilege or what it is, but it is not helpful, because what it means is we're going to do everything badly and wear ourselves out, not incidentally. But if you can imagine that you are surrounded by other little farmers who are doing their best to till their acre, then you don't need to do everything. You need to figure out what your tools are and what the acre is right where you live, and do your very best to bear fruit there.
That is such a beautiful place to close.
Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So, Shana, one thing that I've been thinking about as I reflect on Kathleen's conversation with us, we were talking a lot about virtue, which to my mind relates to the development or the formation of an individual. But as I was listening to some of the virtues that we were talking about, they really are virtues that point towards the ability to make community.
Say more about that, Chris.
So the spiritual practice of compassion, we cultivate compassion certainly to be good and moral people, but compassion by its nature leads us into relationship. And I think the intuition that I have, or the idea or feeling that I'm wanting to express, is that so much of what is difficult in our public life, and I mean public as bigger than the political, but including the political, so much of what is difficult and damaging is our inability to form community. So the virtues we are cultivating don't have an end of making me as an individual a better person. They have a higher aim or end or purpose, at least at this moment in our cultural national life, which is, to my mind, making a broader and deeper community of people.
Maybe it's a both and, because when I think of virtues like humility, patience, and compassion, you know, I think if, and I like the way Kathleen kept framing them in the aspirational, those are virtues that I aspire to. And certainly every once in a while can manifest one. But I think that that makes me a better person. As an individual, it certainly is going to make me more pleasant to be around. I think that the absence of those virtues right now in the public square and in the political realm in particular, with very few exceptions. And we know it when we see it, don't we? When somebody shows up with those virtues, even though we might not be able to consciously identify it, we know that there's something different about that person. And yes, it does build community. It absolutely builds community. But I don't think it just exclusively builds community. One of the things I loved was that very clear definition of spiritual practices. You know that spiritual practices are intentional, attentional, and repeated. In a spiritual practice, we cultivate attention and awareness. And that attention and awareness is so critical if we're going to do so justice work in a different way.
That was one thing that I gravitated towards in her response to your question about how the work for justice is a long,
protracted
struggle. And the beauty of being reminded that we are connected generations before us and we are connected generations mm-hmm. after us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that story about the Ta-Nehisi Coates reading was so incredibly powerful. And I can totally relate to Kathleen's feeling of being liberated by what Ta-Nehisi said regarding we need to till our acre, figure out what is our acre to till, till that, and have faith that our neighbors are doing likewise. And I do think, particularly in this period, one of the things I've observed among my friends who I would normally consider to be political activists is that what sort of stopped them in their tracks is this feeling of being overwhelmed, just being overwhelmed by everything and not knowing where to begin. And it's like, you know, we can wander around the base of the mountain for the rest of our days. It'll never get us to the top. At some point, you just have to, you know, get on a path and start walking. Till your acre.
cultivate those spiritual practices so that you have cultivated enough attention and awareness to know what your acre is, and then cultivate that. I just thought that was just so yummy and, yeah, freeing. We don't have to do it all.
In the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 days, I've been feeling a little bit down about the moral status of our society and culture, and listening to Kathleen and making this show, I felt like I really needed to make this show today with you, because in a way, this is our little acre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's
absolutely
one of the places where you and I are tilling some soil, and it's related to the idea of vocation.
It absolutely is. I was going to say, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I mean, I very often want to be engaged in political action. The work of a parish minister is oftentimes endless. It is wonderful, and it is an honor and a privilege. But the hours oftentimes are long, and there isn't time to do action. And it is helpful in those times to not start thinking that my ministry is taking me away from the real work, but to understand that, you know, one spirit, many gifts.
There's hope in being reminded that responding to our call builds what you call the kingdom.
The kingdom of heaven, yes.
Recognizing that the struggle is long and that we build on what comes before and have a consciousness of what will come after that is bigger than us outside of our lifetimes.
It reminds me of a piece that has been credited to Oscar Romero when he talks about it helps now and again to take the long view and to remember that we will not accomplish all that there is to be done in one lifetime. You know, to realize that there is a difference between a laborer and the master, and we are not the master, but to do our part, to till our garden while we're here.
Any one sparkling takeaway for today, Shana?
Steadfastness. Maybe that's the thing that I want to leave our listeners with, is to pray for you all, to cajole, exhort, cheer you into a place of steadfastness, because we are living in interesting times and our democracy is absolutely under attack, and it will require people of faith, people of virtue to remain steadfast if we're going to hold this ship on some sort of a course.
For me, the takeaway is that beneath or underneath, or I don't know what metaphor of spatial relation I'm looking for, undergirding our political situation is a moral struggle, and it's going to be hard. I'm feeling that. That's the space I'm in at the moment. Like, how difficult is the moral struggle that we are in as a culture? And that manifests in many ways. I use the phrase moral struggle, and that means a whole host of things that we can't quite get into at the moment, but we should. Like, how would we parse that? How would I parse the different elements of a moral struggle? But let's just say we understand what that phrase means, how difficult that is. And to me, my frame of reference to the world, the spiritual connections, how those resources help me to have hope and help me to persevere. When I listen to Kathleen, I feel like that's what she's getting towards and getting at in some ways.
Friends, you've been with us for another episode of What in God's Name. Thank you again for tuning in. As a reminder, you can find us on our Facebook page at
What in God's,
and also online at whatingods.com.
WHATINGODS. Our core values: be curious,
go deep,
and shine light. Shana, great to be with you.
Have a special day, Chris. And to all our listeners, y'all have a sparkling day out there.